Downtown One Right and beginning of the visit, Mr. Nealon, this Saturday morning, the 1st of July 72. Channel One Right and beginning of the visit, Mr. Nealon, this Saturday morning, the 1st of July 72. Channel One Right and beginning of the visit, Mr. Nealon, this Saturday morning, the 1st of July 72. He and Faye hung up out on the ramp looking at Faye's flowers. And it's sometime before the talk begins. Channel One Right, beginning of the visit with Mr. Nealon is Saturday morning, the 1st of July, 72.
People don't follow that. To remain silent when one should speak up makes cowards out of men.
That,
and we see so much of
that.
No,
that
you
me.
Speak up.
No. Oh,
more than most if you don't always. Thank you, ma'am.
You have cream?
Yes, usually. I was brought up when we were kids. We all wanted a cup of coffee back there on the range, and so Mother would fix us up a cup that was 90% milk.
Yeah.
Now I've gotten accustomed to having milk in the coffee. Well, there are times when we should speak up. And I regret that more people of importance don't do that. I don't know. Maybe you are a better psychologist about that. Do you do more harm than good sometimes by speaking up?
Mr. Nealon, I tell you what, it's just the way a fellow does it, you see?
Oh, yes, there is a lot in that.
You know, I always do it, and I get everybody down on me. But, you know, there's a very easy way just to get up and say, now, this is the way it appears to me.
Yeah, if you could keep your tone down and not appear irritated about it.
I think what has gotten me, you know, I look back and I can see so many things I didn't know.
Oh, learning stops with the grave, and I wonder if we don't have our biggest lesson to learn then.
Well, you see, I seemingly felt like if a man gonna get up and speak his piece, he ought to make it pretty strong.
Yes, I think so. And if you don't, the people will not be aroused enough to pay close enough attention. So how to do it gracefully, I grew up on the range out west, way out there, and people were pretty rough and rugged, especially on the ranches and lumber camps. where I worked, as I left home and we lost everything there on the farm through a crooked land deal. And
they really got you, didn't they?
Yeah.
Your daddy.
Yeah, that was just a sad thing. Last April, I was standing up on the hill overlooking where the orchards and vineyards were. Cattle grazing, all abandoned. Nothing there. Now and then, there was one quince tree down in the lower valley, kind of a vale there, still living. One apricot tree had blown down and was still a little bit alive. And the olive trees, they are indestructible. We never had many, just enough, maybe a half dozen or so. And they don't mind no irrigation.
You know, I expect in your case, Mr. Nealon, when you get to the meeting, you don't have to say anything. They already know.
Yes, I've been a conservationist all my life, even when I was growing up, and I was called a fanatic 15, 20 years ago, maybe you were too, because we were talking about saving the environment, and my unschooled way would talk about ecology, which is what it meant, and scorned and thought to be a fanatic. Now, it's quite different. Now it's beginning to attract attention, people. If you're ahead of your time, oh my, you're a lonesome soul.
You're a lonesome soul.
You're not ahead. I wasn't ahead of my time. I was still behind the time, but not as bad as... So, the outdoors is my heaven.
Yeah.
And if I can get out in the hallowed hills of home, mm-hmm. where the buttercups grow in the valley and the larkspurs on the hillside, tulips, many different wildflowers there.
Well?
If I get there in April, then comes May, not a cloud in the sky till November. And the whole world turns dry. All the grassy slopes are white, but they still make good grazing. That grass is nutritious.
Yeah.
And until comes September, they have pretty well gotten the ranges grazed down to where there's very little more. Then comes the rain in late October. Sometimes you get a few showers late in September, and the whole world turns green again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the way it is in Northern California. Or was. They overgraze things terrible.
Yeah.
Now the wildflowers, the hillside across our farm was a slope, and it was open range almost, miles of range, cattle range. And the pansies grew there, the wild pansies, just yellow like ours, but smaller. Hundreds of them, you could pick a bouquet. We kids would go over the hill and first one, I found a pansy. I found one too.
Mm-hmm.
So then from there on they'd be plentiful.
Yeah.
All grazed down to nothing. There's no more place for wildflowers. They
no.
overgraze the range.
There's not even a place for a field mouse.
No, I'm afraid not. Well, the field mice have their place in nature. Nature takes care of everything.
Well, if you don't have a field mouse, you can't have a hawk up there.
That's
looking
right.
For you,
and maybe there are other reasons. That's one thing I complain so much of. The last trip I made 2,000 miles in Northern California, not one jackrabbit did I see.
Not one jackrabbit?
Not one. Where if I got up in the morning early, some 10, 15 years ago, I've been making that trip now for over 20 years, I know my way in the desert. I know what to look for. I know where the roadrunner should show up. I'm not like my friend. He went out there for the first time, and I said, did you see some roadrunners when you got out into West Texas? Yeah, he says, I guess I did. What are they, a tramp? He didn't see anything.
How do they behave, Mr. Dillon? They run?
Oh, they can run like a horse. But they can kill snakes. They're a pretty good-sized bird. Did you grow up where there were magpies?
Mm-hmm.
That's a western bird. You run into them when you get to Kansas. And I often doubted Longfellow's story about Evangeline when the nest of a magpie had some stolen jewelry in it. And I just don't know that up there in Nova Scotia there would be magpies. I've never found them much east of, the central states, the plain states. But that's a black-billed magpie. The Pacific Coast magpie is yellow-billed. And one time, they were quite a pest in your fig orchard. We had 3 acres of figs, and there'd be 50 or 60 of them descend on there and not only eat so many, but they would peck holes in them, which would make them nothing but food for the cattle and horses in winter, the dried ones. So the old times are gone. Nobody there anymore that we knew. You know, when you see everything you build up in 25 years or more, and orchards and vineyards take a while to get productive.
Yeah.
And the early settlers had to struggle for 4 or 5 years till they got the trees and vines and grapes up into production.
Yeah.
And then see it all wither up before your eyes. It's a sad thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, we went to court. Why should it take 2 years for the courts to decide that was a breach of contract? They're compelled to furnish us water. The corporation appeals to a higher court. We were already almost ruined. And Dad says, well, that may take us 3 years, then there won't be anything left here in 3 more years without water, and we'd be ruined anyhow, and it'll cost us money to fight in the court. So the whole community went. One man drank himself to death. Another one put a bullet through his head.
Mm.
You know, then you get to be 55, 60,
yeah.
65. It's too late to start over again.
Yeah, you look back at all that work you put in.
Yeah.
You can't see doing it all over again.
You know, love of money is the source of all evil. Just because for 2 or 3 years, maybe 5, the gold dredging crowd could pay 10 times more for irrigation water than a farmer could.
Oh, that's what happened.
Beautiful peaches put up in 10-pound boxes, 2 cents a pound. 20 cents for a 10-pound box. That's the best you could do. It had to be high-quality product. So you couldn't afford to pay so much for irrigation water, not to compete with the gold diggers. Now they left the valleys all in 15-foot-high cobblestone piles, ruined the soil forever, and that was rich river bottom land. All wrong. All wrong. Those generations to come have to face that. So everything isn't all right in our country, and still isn't all right in anybody's country.
No. But you are the bottom rail that's put on top now, Mr.
Your old bottom rail got on top, you think? In some ways, it's really funny.
Yeah.
Because with all the opposition, you know, the profession, they just rate me an unqualified man because I don't have a degree in forestry. And anything I do is ignored and condemned.
Yes, a man can't do anything worthwhile
Without a degree, that's it. And that they'll never overcome that.
No.
Now, there are a few exceptions. Maybe at the whole school of forestry, too. That are not that way. That regard what you do, if they think it's worthwhile, they'll say so. But the rest, if they can't, no one has ever criticized anything I have suggested or have done. But ignored, oh boy.
Just ignore it.
Yeah. It's the safest way.
Yeah.
Don't they know if I'm right or wrong? Got out quite a publication here about 16 years ago on hardwoods because the county agent said, now you're retiring and we'll have lost all our source of information on our important hardwood trees like hickory and white oak and sweet gum, tulip poplar and many others. And wish you'd write down what you know about them. So I did, and our editor, you know Frank Cooper?
No.
He's editor for the University Experiment Station and Extension Service. He thought well of what I had put out, and he said, I want some pictures to go with that to illustrate what you said. And we went out, he took me out to West Florida. That trip didn't cost me anything. And took pictures. The professors condemned the whole thing, not backed up with constituted research. Did they find something wrong with it? They wouldn't know whether I was right or wrong.
Yeah.
But the whole thing was blocked.
Well, what happened to your publication?
Oh, I finally got it approved as a typewritten... what do they call this thing where they multiply it? They have a new word for it now, where they duplicate it. They finally would permit it to come out without pictures or anything, just a typewritten book. But, you know, a picture's worth 10,000 words, and if you can show him the person what you're talking about, it makes it much more... interesting and understandable.
And that's been 15 years.
16 years now. No. I retired 16 years ago. But I'm carrying on. Oh, I brought one of my last reports.
Yeah.
I need, you know, I'm unlettered and unlearned.
Too bad about you, Mr. Nye.
So, I'm not as bad as they think. When we were out there were no high schools, out there in them woods, hills. So, we took international correspondence school courses in math and English, and studied those. And when I finished my two-year course, you know, when I enrolled here in 1910-11, lawyers at eighth grade, no high school, an eighth grade certificate and permitted the lawyers to enroll. But me, I just come spend a year down there clearing up ground, digging stumps and burning out stumps. I was all scorched up, and when I got in there they decided I wasn't college material. No. But I had some correspondence with the dean. My writing must not have been too bad. With the dean before I came, and he said, yes, you have an opportunity to come in. I said, I don't have any money. I'll have to find a work, and nobody ever gave me a first dime. So I hoed weeds at 12 and a half cents an hour when I wasn't in class to make my board, books, and lodging. Well, when I got through, the dean took them up to a side room, and I think he lectured them, Dean J.J. Vernon. He was a fine person. He was a Quaker. And came from Pennsylvania, I think, originally. Anyway, he must have given them a lecture, because when they came back in again, they permitted me to enroll. So then, after 2 years of intensive study there, I wasn't bothered with spherical trigonometry and stuff like that, so I just took extra courses and took a good course in veterinary science, practical course. And I got through, I went back to the farm to give my younger brothers an opportunity to come too. I hadn't been home but a few months when they wrote me and wanted me to be farm foreman on the experimentation farm, and they passed up the 4-year men. They didn't know how to put the collar on the mule. In those days, they were rich men's sons, you know, and they hadn't. The only reason most of them were taking agriculture, their dads up in the north had an orange grove down here in Florida and wanted them to study agriculture so they could take care of the grove. Well, there's a difference between whether you studied to pass an examination or whether you studied to know. And maybe you run into that too.
Oh, yeah.
So I worked at that for 3 years and a half, and then when the war broke out, World War One broke out, I enlisted in the service, and they kept my job for me, but Dad's health failed. He couldn't take this low ground smog when they burned the woods. And I came home on a furlough one night, 10 o'clock, at a little farm, and he was sitting up at the table, had a little glass of kerosene in front of him. He says, I have to take a sip of this once in a while. It's the only thing keeps me breathing. I said, when this war is over, I'm coming to take this piece of dirt over, and you go back to the hills where you never had any trouble. So he did. And I didn't come back to claim a job. Well, I hadn't been there but a little while before on the farm, and before they said, they called me up, the county commissioners called me up one night and said, we want you to be county agent, the only qualified man in the county. Why didn't they go to another county and get a good man? Well,
yeah.
You know, if you try, people appreciate it. So I think I put in there about 6 or 7 years, nearly 8 years as county agent, and I was pretty active. I could find things to do. And then the county depression came on, and there was no more money in the agricultural fund, and so a little county, you know, poor county. So I worked on 5 more months without my $60 a month. Buy a car and run it all day, didn't need an office, for $120 a month. So I didn't like to let the farmers down. They were all very loyal, and so I finally told the wife, you can't support a family even if you do have a garden and a cow and some chickens on $60 a month. I'm still getting my state and federal. So just then, the State Forest Service was organized here in 1928. The state forestry came down. I was promoting forestry down there like nobody's business with 4-H. Well, he said, if you're that much interested, you should be working for us. Well, I was in a poor position to refuse work I loved, and I wasn't getting my pay, so... I went with them for about nearly 8 years, and then the university called me back. Still an unqualified man.
You mean the hard times come that early? It did. The hard times come early on the farms.
Oh, yes, yes.
Way under before the big depression.
And you have to learn to depend on your own resourcefulness if you have any.
Yes.
And that's worth something for young people to know. Now, what's the matter with the youth of the country?
They got too much.
I think that's one thing.
They got way under too much.
We're surrounded in our little neighborhood with hippies now.
Yeah.
Oh.
Guy, is that colonel trying to go like a mockingbird?
Yeah.
I wish I could hear. I cannot hear the birds anymore. The only thing I can hear is...
That's a mockingbird, I believe.
Cooing of doves and the call of the crow, low sounds I can hear, but not...
Why, that's the first mockingbird I have heard, Mr.
Celebrating Mr. Nealon's coming.
Yeah.
Well, why do you suppose that he has come back?
I'm telling you, I like cardinals, but I just to wake up in the morning and hear a cardinal sitting out there on a limb trying to go like a mockingbird, that gets tiresome.
Yes, well, it is a kind of monotonous call that they have.
Well, he does the best he can.
Yeah, well, you have to give him credit. Anyway, there's this about birds, and I don't know too much about them myself, but the bird that is on the ground first, he holds that area against all
other
things.
Well, these mockingbirds were here in droves before.
Well, it all depends how close. Now, the redbird may have considered this particular territory where he calls as his domain, and he'll fight like a madman any other bird that wants to come into his, what he thinks is his territory. Mockingbirds usually prevail over him, but your redbirds must be more determined than some.
Oh, they must be. Now, they've had it at least 2 years that I can think of. I didn't notice it anyway until last year.
Who had it?
The mockingbirds.
Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The cardinals here, the mockingbird didn't bother them.
No. I can't understand it either. I'm just trying to guess what happened, but I have noticed this, that any bird, when the nesting time comes, stakes out his territory and defends it. He fights like a wild man. And if the mockingbird should happen to be a young one, first year, he might not be determined to fight it out. He might move out a little further.
Well, that's right. But I haven't even seen him out a little further.
Must have gone quite a fur piece, is it?
Yeah. You know, these pokeberries come on pretty soon.
Yeah.
They almost
right.
ready to come
Are
on.
Are they out yet? Are they turned black yet?
No, but they won't be long.
Won't be long.
Well,
are they a good source for your birds?
Oh, yes. Yes, they all eat them. Well, what I've seen out there, I've seen a mockingbird just take over a pokeberry bush, and he wouldn't let anybody else come to there.
Oh, yes.
Until he got tired sitting there, and he'd have to fly off.
Yeah,
and then the cardinals
would
come in.
That's right. Well, cardinals are not much for, they're seed eaters largely, they're not much for berries, but during the nesting season I think they feed the young on some berries.
Yeah, well they nest all year.
Yeah. All year? No, oh, not completely all year, do
well,
you?
Well now they've got this bunch, they're big enough, they're out there on the station.
I think two generations is about all, maybe there's three, I don't know.
Well, I... Oh, yeah, I meant...
they usually taper off come September.
Yeah.
With their nesting, but now there are always exceptions.
Yeah.
They'll
go clear on up to September, though.
Yes, so they will, especially if the nest has been disturbed and they've lost it, then they'll try over
well,
again.
How many ordinarily would that be? Just two?
Seasons, two nesting
seasons.
Two batches. Ordinarily, I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, they can start mighty early, Mr. Eastman.
Yeah. But a snake climbs up there and eats the eggs or the young, and then they have to start all over again.
Yeah.
And so you'll have some pretty late.
Yeah. They've taken up these bushes all around the house. Mm. You see,
oh,
you
have?
The cardinals.
Oh,
and you hear them down there talking and
everything. Yes, you don't find cardinals unless you have shrubs.
Yeah.
They seem to require that. Oh, well, there's a lot. Maybe we have humanized the birds. We have created unusual conditions, and therefore they may have to carry on in different ways than they used to.
Yeah. Yes, they've had to put up with a lot.
Yeah, adjust. Well, we do too.
Yes, that's the truth.
And if we can't, we are sunk.
We're in bad shape.
Except if you were in forestry, you'd have a PhD.
Yeah.
You don't have to know anything.
Yeah. Now, those fellas, I understand it. Mr. Nealon, they're going to have $1 million building over there to sit in.
Yeah, well, I'm for that. Forestry has been too long neglected. I made a talk one time while I was farm foreman on the experiment station farm. I think the faculty club, somebody conked out on speech and they heard me rattling around about forestry. We ought to take better care of our forests here, not burn them all up. And so they put me on the program, and I was in 1915. And I told them what the situation was. I remember one thing I said, you can always tell where the last strong wind came from, because the turpentine trees would catch fire and the face would burn, the gum wolf. Then the turpentine beetle would gain entrance. He wouldn't get through the covering of gum, but fire burns that off. Then the beetle gets in. Then comes the storm and the trees all fall over because the heart has been mined out with the turpentine beetle. So you can tell which way the last strong wind blew by the way the injured, pine-destroyed trees fell. Still living, but weakened. Well, they thought I was touching the head, talking about forestry. We always had plenty and we always will. That was the prevailing attitude in those days. But now things are quite different, especially since we got a State Forest Service. But when the State Forester came down and said, we need men who can think and plan, well, I took that seriously. Whose vocation doesn't require thinking and planning, especially in public service? Of course it doesn't. So, I worked with them. They gave me a very difficult job. I had to supervise fire line plowing from Florella, Alabama to St. Augustine. Farm equipment, all was broken down. You didn't have the right castings. You didn't have the right material. And so it just kept me... I drove by night and tried to help and keep the equipment going by day in all those counties. So after that year, the state forester, he's the one who came down and hired me. He said he promoted me to district forester. Oh, that killed all the young graduates. Oh, how they hated me. Unqualified man being given the job we should have. See, that's the trouble. And so they'd block you on everything. You'd have to fight them more than you would the destructive forest practices. Anyway, I planned out a multiple use program in 1930.
Way back then?
Yeah, I had it practicalized thing. And I had it all written down, briefed in one typewritten page, and sent it to the state forester. But his assistant got opened the mail first, immediately pigeonholed that crazy stuff. So, about 3 months or so later, the state forester, I was stationed in Trenton then. That was the headquarters for the district, 12 counties. So he wrote me and said, do you have any suggestions on our terrible fire program losses in this state? We are just ruined and we don't have any control. Well, I just wrote back. I said, I sent you my suggestions about something like 3 months previously. And he made them dig out that those suggestions, and he was the only man that approved it. And he told the rest of you fellows, let Nealon alone, he's working on something. 40 years later, the U.S. Forest Service adopted that program, hook, line, and sinker, as their new idea.
Yeah.
And now I think that's the way with my hardwoods research out there.
Yeah.
They're waiting for the old so-and-so to die so we can claim the thing.
Yeah.
And then foresters talk about ethics. You know, I think the human race is a little short of ethics.
Well, they have to play the game, Mr. Nealon. And let me tell you, you see, they're so rich. These bureaus are all so rich.
Yeah, that's one problem. You're right.
And
they have more money than they know what to do with.
Yes, sir. And somebody, as the fellow says, somebody got to get it.
Yeah, oh, yes. There's a little cartoon in the paper the other day, someone standing, no, he was sitting on the edge of the politician's desk, and they were discussing something, apparently, just a cartoon drawing. And the politician says, well, what are the issues, the national good or my re-election? And the cartoonist, few people, they understand, they see it just as you and I do, but the only thing that counts is the election, nothing else.
Well, Mr. Nealon, you haven't been in touch with old Cornwell.
Yes, I have been quite closely in touch with him. He was president of our Alderman Society for a year.
Oh, was he?
And he did excellent work. As president, he was enthusiastic about it, he was friendly, he always smiled, but he had excellent background material for us to help promote conservation.
Yeah.
Now that is the thing that killed him, just the same as my multiple use program back there in 1930 killed me with it. Oh, I know why the U.S. Forest Service adopted the program. We extension foresters had meetings throughout the Southeast about every 2-3 years, and one time we were studying U.S. Forest Service research institutions in different counties and parts of the South. Well, one time a young forester was to take us out to a little over 2,000 acre forest, and that man, Holt Walton was the young fellow's name, his dad, long before there was such a thing as a state forest service in the South, or much in the way of U.S. Forest Service like in the South, he had planted thousands of slash pines, and they had some beautiful forests planted. And the U.S. boys wanted that area for research purposes because it was the oldest planting in the South. And so he said, well, you can have my 2,500 acre tract provided you put in, and he showed him my bulletin, this program. Oh, no. How'd I find that out? Holt Walton gave us extension foresters, about a dozen of us, a barbecue out in the woods for supper one night. And I got talking with him, and he told me how it happened that my program, see, when we drove up to the boundary of that U.S. Forest Service research project, there, and my superior in Washington always scorned my wide grazing strips protecting the stands of timber. But when I walked up, there was about a dozen cars in the whole motorcade out there. The young man was standing there at the edge, and there was a 100-foot grazing strip, closely grazed grass with cattle on it. So when I came up, I asked the young forester, he hadn't begun to talk. I said, where do you get this fool idea? I pointed out those strips of grazing strips, protective barriers. Well, he says, we heard about it. Well, I said, you ever see a little publication, Timber Grazing and Game by Nealon? Yeah, he said, we've been quoting from him. Well, I said, I'm the old geezer that wrote it. So, that night, Holt Walton explained to me, I got a hold of him privately, and I said, yes, he says, I got a hold of your bulletin, and I told those U.S. boys that they could have my land for their research purposes, provided they put in this program, because I've had too much trouble with fire. He was a turpentine operator, too.
Yeah.
Like his dad before him. And, oh, no, they said they wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't fool with that. Okay, he says, then you can't have my property for your research purposes with those ancient stands of planted pines. Well, after a while, he said they relented and said they would put it in. And they did. They did a good job. They followed my instructions completely. A good job so far as I know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I asked the young fellow, I said, did you used to have trouble here with fire? Was this often burned? Yeah, he said, it was. Did you have any trouble since you put in these boundary and dividing strips? No, he said, I haven't. In a dry time, he said, I have noticed that the fire would burn maybe halfway, as far as halfway across that protected barrier where the grass is so much better than the native grass. They kept it so short, like a mown lawn. It would burn that far and then die. Where nobody was near. Sometimes fires creep up at night or some other time when you don't notice them. So, it wasn't more than 4 or 5 years before the U.S. boys, that was back in 1952 or 3 or 4, somewhere along there, I still have the bulletin, came out with a bulletin recommending it.
Yeah.
But that's our idea.
Yeah.
All right.
Always,
yeah. So, where is Essex?
Well,
I don't know. In your work, do you have difficulties like that? Are you sometimes suggesting something you can't get support for?
Well, let me tell you, Mr. Nealon, my work is altogether different.
Oh, I know.
You see, we don't have any public function. All we do
is... Oh, yes, I know. You're restricted to teaching, pretty much.
All we do is write books.
And you write books, too?
Yeah.
You try to keep teaching up to date that way, or introduce new and better methods of teaching?
No, we don't we don't pay much attention to teaching, you see. We just go in and talk. We don't have the problem you have. We don't have to teach them anything.
You don't have to do much pioneering.
Well, we don't have... When they get out of our class, they don't have to do anything, you see.
Oh, just the main thing is graduate.
That's right. We can graduate them.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've often said...
I think every outfit ought to be tied down to some public function.
Yeah, right.
Something visible.
That's right. Something challenging. A principle learned... is of absolutely no use until, or unless, you know if, when, where, why, and how to practicalize it.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, well, your principle learned appears valueless,
yeah.
Dead.
Oh, there's dozens of things that they could learn to do in the sort of work we have with them. But you see...
They don't have to.
We don't know it ourselves.
No, you haven't been taught either. No, but...
Now, see, here's one thing. Here's one thing we can do that you can't do. Except we can show you how. You see, the journalism people are the ones who have the function, but they don't do too well at it. They just mediocre.
Well,
you
most
see,
of them, don't you have some outstanding ones?
Well, it's not a question. It's just, you see, you can just say so much in a journalistic article.
Oh, yes,
and
you're restricted, too.
Then they don't want anymore.
So the paper won't publish it.
Well, I'll tell you, if you wait a minute, what I mean. You see, we could teach them this, and it's in the things that we have, you see... We've got Steinbeck and Faulkner and people like that, people who can listen. We could teach some of, we could teach all those chaps to go out there and talk to Neyland. Follow him around a week or two. Set it down. And they can do it, Mr. Neyland. I've taught them to do it.
Oh, so important.
Yes.
So important. You're making something of it.
Yes, but I don't get anywhere with it. See, the others don't care about
it. I understand.
But see, what I would like for them to do, you see, we don't know anything about what goes on around us. We got no reporting. You don't learn anything much from the newspaper.
No.
Just little snippets,
no.
You see.
Now and then you get a hint.
Just a hint. That's right. Well, now these fellas, you see, they could come out. One of these fellas, I've got several right now working with me. They could follow you around for a day or two. And you wouldn't have to spend any time with them. Wouldn't have to spend as much time as you are with me right now. And they could set down everything you said.
Get a hold of something.
Yes. And furthermore, they'd set it down the way it would sound like you. Yes, sir. They can do that.
And
your
attitude is you're short of that.
Yes. Yes. You see, you can't tell anybody what goes on out there. That's not your function. You can take them out there and show them, but these chaps can tell them.
Yes. The most important people we have are the newspaper writers. And if they don't measure up to their high requirements, then how good is their training?
Yeah. Well, yeah, some of them are pretty fair, but the newspapers don't give them much leeway.
No, that's right. They're restricted there.
Very restricted. Yes.
But I think
I have seen it done, and I've trained them, and you see, when I trained them, I learned a little bit myself.
Why, you have to every day, almost.
Yes.
There's so many new approaches and better approaches to anything. I have to learn every day. And if you're in the woods, if you're very observant, close observer, you learn a little more.
Yeah, well, I mean, now I'll tell you what you could do. You could I'm talking about young people.
Yeah, that's the ones we're interested in.
23 or 4 years old. Now, you see, they gotta harden the muscles. They can't come out of a classroom and do it. They gotta.
I understand.
But now I'll tell you what they could do in this Cornwell thing. You could send one of them over there and talk to Mr. Gray. And just tell him, go ahead and tell us what you see. Just make it official. Just go ahead and tell us now what's been happening over here.
Yeah.
And they can listen to him, and they can set it down. They go over there and do the same thing with Cornwell. And that way, you don't have all this pulling back and forth.
Well,
when you get into due process, Mr. Neyland, you don't get anything straight.
Into what?
Due process.
No, what do you mean with due process?
Well, that's a legal matter, you know. That's a legal system. Due process of law.
Oh, an old custom.
Yes.
An established principle.
Yes. When you are investigating a thing by the due process method,
mm-hmm.
You see, all it is mechanical, well, and it's overdone. And legalized and mechanical and all like that?
Well, I think I know what the problem is with Cornwell. Those old props there have gone down their little narrow trail, and they know that.
Yeah.
But they won't step out to right or left, because then they'd be lost.
Yeah.
And he's come in here with something new, just as I did with my multiple use program. Something new.
Yeah.
By the way, I wrote that bulletin, Timber Grazing and Game, a Multiple Use Approach. I still have a few copies left. And the director of extension called me over the other day and said, we want to show that extension thought about multiple use 27 years ago. Well, I said, I've been talking that since 1930, but with all the resistance of the state and U.S. Forest Service and School of Forestry, I still got some people to put 2,500 acres into the program. And for 15 years, it turned out to be a huge success. Then I wrote my bulletin, Timber Grazing and Game, which is a multiple use. I included wildlife and many other things, plants and trees of value to the beekeeper and things like that. Multiple use. Well, scorn, but I do remember this. I had a packet of 30 letters from North Carolina to Louisiana of people. Some were even foresters, some were executives, and the general consensus is your program should be adopted throughout the South. That's 30 years ago nearly. So you see how slowly a new process. Now that's the trouble with Cornwell. Those old fellows across at the school there, all the PhDs, they just work with tabulation. As I used to say, they are figuring out just what killed the man. But what we need is preventative medicine to save him. Oh, it hadn't been done yet. Don't touch it. So it's just history they're writing. But that doesn't, their technical things are no good. But now, in my timber grazing bulletin that the director wants to reprint. Nowadays, things are different. The School of Forestry has to prove that. They don't know what it's all about, never will.
Yeah.
But they have to prove it, so they won't approve it. So he's having trouble getting it. Why, if it's wrong, can't they say you're wrong?
Yeah.
No, just forget it. Don't do anything about it.
Oh, I see.
They can't claim it, in other words. Now, those old profs there, they haven't been trained in multiple use. That, 30, 40 years ago when they were students, that was never mentioned. Now, that would disturb their ancient solitary way.
You mean they still got some of those ancient...
Yeah, they got too much of that influence. John Gray'd be different. I know John. I used to meet with him up in Carolina and Georgia and South Carolina and North Carolina in our conference. He's a good man.
Yeah.
But I think he's caught in the school almost unanimously is opposed to Cornwell because they don't want to be disturbed in their old little narrow way of teaching.
Yeah.
They don't have your idea to prepare people for action.
Yeah.
No, just to teach them what's in the book and no more.
Yeah.
Well, what's in the book is 10 years behind the time forestry moves on. So the big trouble there is he has something that, well, they call him a fanatic just as they called me a fanatic 20 years ago, and you too, because you're interested in conserving the natural heritage we have little left now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to have much patience in kind of work.
Now, Cornwell... very well for the Audubon.
He certainly did. He stood for the right thing all the time and wanted Audubon to do more. But you know, all Audubon members, with few exceptions,
yeah,
want to do is to attend a meeting and
yeah,
hear a talk, and
yeah,
that is plenty. No action, thank you.
Well, now, I'm glad you said that. I had noticed, you see, now you've been right in there with him, and I haven't. But, I lost interest in them. All I could see they ever did was get out and everybody get in his own car and drive out and look at something.
Look at something. That's enough.
After they get there, they ought to take hold and do something.
Do something. Men's Garden Club. We got a bunch of those. I've been belonging now for 10, 12 years or more. They don't want to do one thing except hear a talk. Well, I said, told them the other day, he who serves but himself serves but little. Those old sayings, you know, they'll rock you if you think about them.
Yes.
And so I said, why don't we support something? There are schools we could make a contribution by planting certain ornamentals that were needed there, things like that, or for the city. No, nothing.
Yeah.
Well, then I don't want to belong, same as you gave up. I don't want to belong anymore.
Yeah.
If there's no action in it, I don't care about it.
Yeah.
It's just a dead thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mr. Nealon, it took me so long to appreciate it. I knew better, but I didn't seem to do better. You see, I would do like almost, not quite as much, but I'd do pretty bad. You see, with these big old rotary mowers now, you can just take everything right down with an inch of the ground.
Yeah.
And you've got no cover for a bumblebee.
No. You mean in mowing pastures, they mow too close?
You don't leave any bushes.
Oh,
you
I
clean
see.
Out your fence rows.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have a little thicket
no,
out here anywhere.
No, they would condemn that.
You see, you got a little thicket, a blackberry thicket down there.
Yeah.
Well, you can't run straight into it, but you can back into it.
Yeah.
And just clean the whole thing out. Looks like the table.
You're very unusual. And that's what's the trouble with the School of Forestry. They don't want to take in a new idea. That's just disturbing.
Yeah.
And so,
you know, I was going along over here the other day with one of my friends, and we passed one of those new horse farms. And he looked out there and said, ain't that pretty? I said, no, it's not pretty. It's disgusting. And he don't care what I say to him, you see.
No.
He's one of my buddies. But that's the response.
Yeah, nothing but grass and horses, and nothing else.
Yes, and such expense.
And what?
At such a great cost.
Oh, yeah. It takes a while. You know, we are making progress. I've been talking this thing for, well, ever since 1915.
Yeah.
And we've made progress.
Well, thank you for the nice coffee.
What's the matter here?
I got something to show you out here.
Oh.
Oh, Lord, yes.
I just had this little bit to do there.
Well, I didn't want to hold you up.
No, I'm not doing anything.
All the children gone.
Mostly. We have young people around here all the time.
Oh, others.
Yeah.
But your people off.
Yeah.
Making a living.
Mr. Nealon, the way it appeared to me over there, I sat in the court for 2 days. I didn't go tonight, and that's I missed the best time.
Oh,
that Monday night.
In the court.
Cornwell.
Oh, did you get in on that? I stayed away from there because I would just be a disturbing influence at the School of Forestry.
Everybody should have been over there.
Yeah, I think you're right now. I think I should have been there.
Well, let me tell you.
That they don't like me.
But it was...
I have nothing against me personally, but they don't want my influence.
They had all... they were going to a great deal of trouble to get the truth of the matter, but the truth of the matter was clear to start with. Cornwell has nothing in common with the forestry people, and the provost, you know, that sort of dictator, he has been here.
Who is
York?
He has his limitations.
Well, it was perfectly clear, you see, if Cornwell didn't lose his temper sometimes, they call him abrasive.
Call him a what?
Abrasive.
Oh, yes. Abrasive.
Yes, that he was sharp with the students and sharp
oh,
with his colleagues
yeah.
and all like
yeah.
that. Well, if that won't make you abrasive, I don't know what will.
No. Well, The great trouble, I think, is, maybe I need to know more about it too, is that the old-time way of teaching does not want to accept anything new, no matter what.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't in the books we studied, and it's not in our program. And he's trying to choke something down. Actually, they don't know anything about it, or they wouldn't be so against it.
He wasn't abrasive down there with you all.
No, always friendly and always on solid ground.
Yes.
So I don't know his abrasiveness.
Always
good natured. But the trouble with them is they have gotten, they're just like my farmers and forest owners in the early days. They don't want to be disturbed. Nothing new, thank you.
I want Mr. Nealon now, in case I want him to see that filly.
Well, I do too.
But that's the trouble up there. They resent and resist anything that's new. All the forestry publications, I get three, national and one old forester up there, that's a German name, I can't. He has a PhD in forest economics, and one day he came down to my office and he was different.
Yeah.
And I didn't know him. I didn't know he knew what I was doing, if I was doing it.
Yeah.
And he said, "Your work record shows that you're entitled to junior membership in the Society of American Foresters." That's the sacrosanct organization.
Is that right?
And I want to recommend you. Well,